Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Escape from East Berlin by Andy Marino. Narrated by A.W. Miller. Prologue. November 13, 1961.
This wetsuit is 8 sizes too small, Johann Hoffman says. He's slight and long-limbed, nicknamed Die Eritze, the minnow, by his fellow swimmers at the secondary school in Prenzlauer Berg, East Berlin. He reaches underneath his heavy peacoat and pulls at the rubber that hugs his body like a bandage.
"Shh,"
says his best friend, Stefan Dietrich. He keeps his voice near a whisper as the two boys creep through the shadows at the edge of the Alexanderufer, a road just east of Humboldt Harbor.
"Why don't you yell at the Tropos on the bridge and tell them we're coming?"
"Maybe I should," Johann says. "At least then it'll make things interesting." Johann swims the anchor leg of the freestyle relay. He's the fastest swimmer on the team, but Stefan fears that his friend thinks he can outswim a bullet. The blue-uniformed Tropos, transit police, guard the new border between East and West Berlin, patrolling the sealed-off stations and train bridges that only 3 short months ago served as busy hubs for all Berliners. Every guard has been commanded to obey the order of Schießbefehl, the shoot-on-sight command issued from the very top of East Berlin's government. There have been stories in the Neues Deutschland newspaper of border crossers losing their lives. Spies and agents of the Americans, the paper claims, criminals, deserters, traitors, weak-minded fools seduced by the West. Stefan has pointed this out to Johann, tried to get him to understand the danger of what they're about to do, but his friend only laughs. "They were trying to start a whole new life in the West. We're just crossing over for a few hours to visit Petra and Millie, then we're coming back home." As if the Tropos on the railway bridge can tell from 100 meters away that a couple of idiots swimming the harbor at midnight are only going to West Berlin for a quick visit.
"That's us," Stefan mutters. "A couple of gigantic idiots."
"I wouldn't say gigantic," Johann says, only half as hushed as Stefan wishes he would be.
"Maybe regular idiots?"
The Alexanderufer is a wide street with a concrete median splitting it in two. Stefan can see headlights approaching from a kilometer away. Then comes the telltale rattle of the engine of Trabant, the boxy spark plug on wheels that's everywhere in East Berlin. Without a word, the boys duck down behind a trash can. Stefan wrinkles his nose at the stench of rotten fruit. Johann laughs softly as the Trabant clatters past.
"Listen to that engine purr."
"Petra drives a Volkswagen," Stefan says wistfully. Before the wall went up on the night of August 13th, East and West were divided by a million other things. If your family owned a reliable car that didn't sound like an accident waiting to happen, you probably lived in the West.
"I hope she's got some towels down when she picks us up," Johann says. "Or we'll get nasty harbor water all over those nice seats."
The Trabant chugs away south, turns along the horseshoe curve of the Spree, and vanishes into the night.
"Come on," Stefan says.
Together, the boys move from behind the trash can and pick up the route along the street. Stefan's eyes roam the darkness. If they were to get stopped here, 50 meters from the harbor, dressed in winter coats and skin-tight wetsuits, it would be a disaster. He imagines the guard's astonishment at how easily he just caught a pair of obvious border crossers.
"Cold night for a swim, boys."
Then they would be whisked away to the secret prison on the outskirts of East Berlin, the forbidden area he's only ever heard about in whispers.
"Stefan."
His mind reels with visions of isolation cells, maggots in the food, sleep deprivation. That is, if they aren't simply shot on sight.
"Stefan!"
Johann's voice pulls him back to reality. Stefan's heart races. He takes a breath, tries to locate the sense of calm he always finds before he jumps off the blocks to lead their relay team.
"What is it?" "Did you bring any snacks?"
"We're about to jump into the harbor."
"Do you think Petra will have some?"
Suddenly a searchlight blinks on like a flick switch from nothing to something.
"Get down!"
Stefan pulls his friend into the mulch that makes up a little strip of earth between the street and the harbor's edge. Together, they scramble behind a low-slung makeshift lean-to,
nothing more than a tarp stretched over some scrap wood, sheltering a pile of rusted pipes. The light sweeps across the top of their hiding place. Stefan presses himself into the dirt.
"It's coming from up on the train bridge," he whispers.
The roving beam changes direction and pokes around the street, the empty dirt strip, the concrete embankment. The way it moves reminds Stefan of his Rottweiler puppy, Penelope, chasing squirrels in the Volkspark Friedrichshain, darting this way and that, picking up one scent after another, overwhelmed by sensation. In this way, the beam is disturbingly alive. As it zips across the embankment, leaving them in darkness, Johann peeks above the tarp.
"I guess they're not using the train bridge for trains anymore," he says.
Cautiously, Stefan raises his head. An odor wafts up from the embankment, that fishy, briny smell he associates with the open sea, not a grubby little bottleneck of an inland harbor. The hulking shadow of a barge glides out from beneath the bridge. A man in a peaked cap floats by in a little square of light, a specter in the boat's wheelhouse. Stefan raises his eyes to the bridge. At first, he can't see much of anything with the searchlight blinding him. But as the beam slides away across the black water, his eyes adjust. There are men on the walkway between the tracks and the guardrail, a dozen of them at least. A cold knot forms in his gut.
Trapos, tons of them.
"They weren't there yesterday,"
Johann says. They'd come by after school to scout their route. Unlike the other checkpoints choked with razor wire and guards, the harbor seemed like an afterthought for the border patrol. Yesterday, they'd seen a total of 2 Trapos. There was even a train line from the west that had to use the bridge to loop through the eastern section. The city had never been designed to be sliced in half overnight, so little quirks like this remained up and down the border, bulges in the wall as if the city's soft center were being squeezed out like clay in a fist.
"Maybe we should come back some other time,"
Stefan suggests.
"And by then, Petra and Millie will have lots of time to think about how stupidly hard it is to see us, and how easy it is to see the boys in West Berlin. They'll decide it's really not worth it, all this sneaking around and waiting in the dark for these 2 regular idiot swimmers to climb out of Humboldt Harbor and get smelly dead fish water all over the leather seats of their beautiful..."
"Okay, Johann.
Volkswagen. I get it." So, off they go, Petra and Millie both, back to Charlottenburg for a couple of Coca-Colas in the American sector, where they just happened to run into 2 guys from their class. You know, the 2 best football players in all of West Berlin, very handsome, who also happened to have 2 empty seats at their table.
"Johann!" But Stefan knows this is plausible enough, and it isn't like they can rush home to call the girls and explain why they didn't show up. There haven't been telephone links between East and West Berlin since Stefan and Johann were 8 years old. Now, at 17, the boys rely on the steadily dwindling workers who are still allowed to cross the border, under close supervision, to commute to their jobs. For the price of a few pfennigs, one of these commuters could be relied upon to pass messages to Millie and Petra. In this way, they make plans to meet, but such plans take days or even weeks to come together. Carrier pigeons would be a more efficient system. Messages in a bottle placed on the spree, perhaps. Cautiously, with just the top of his head poking above the tarp, Stefan rethinks their plan. The searchlight pokes into the shadows of the opposite embankment. Stefan watches, absorbing the layout of the western side of the harbor. As the light moves across the rickety wooden steps that rise from an old mooring jetty, the exit point they scouted yesterday, Stefan is struck by a feeling of profound unease. It's not fear, exactly, though there is a little of that, too. It's more like the idea that the city itself is betraying them from within. That what they counted on as real, as solid as the pavement, can be changed overnight. Borders closed according to the wills of stern old politicians Stefan will never meet, and who will never know his name. What will the city look like tomorrow morning, or the morning after that? Who's to say those faceless politicians won't decide to wall in Prenzlauer Berg, or Kreuzberg, or Friedrichshain? Who would stop them? The searchlight darts back across the harbor. It scans the water, then moves along the edges of the train bridge, the Trapos aiming it straight down so the beam is a vertical tower of light connecting harbor to bridge.
"We gonna sit here all night?"
Johann says, rubbing his upper arms and shoulders.
"It's freezing."
The bridge, Stefan says, following the path of the searchlight. Instead of going straight across and aiming for that old jetty, we cross directly underneath the bridge. The light can't find us there.
Johann takes off his jacket, bunches it up, and stashes it beneath the tarp with the pipes. He makes a fist and holds it up. Stefan lays a hand atop his friend's fist, palm to knuckles.
What do we say to second place?
Johann asks.
Nothing, Stefan answers. Second place doesn't exist.
Their familiar pre-race chatter is a comfort. He feels a pang of longing for Jonas and Michael, the other two members of their freestyle relay. He invited them to come along tonight, but they declined. How amazing would that be, the four of them hitting the black water of Humboldt Harbor as one? The fastest relay team in East Berlin, crossing right under the Tropos noses, there and back before dawn. Ah, well, the other boys don't know what they're missing.
Stefan clears his mind and feels his body give over to his training. He enters a space where jitters and calm are perfectly in balance, alert but not overly keyed up.
He removes his own jacket and stuffs it onto the pile next to Johann's. Then he takes off his shoes and hides them, too. He blows hot air into his cupped hands, rubs his shoulders, and waits for the searchlight to drift toward the opposite embankment. A stray dog's mournful howl floats across the harbor. Stefan thinks of Penelope, then clears his mind. With that, he leads Johann in a low jog across the dirt strip. The land dips sharply toward the water as the struts of the bridge rise from the earth. For a brief moment, the moonlight seems bright as the sun, and Stefan feels horribly exposed. One of the Tropos laughs, and it sounds like he's right beside them. The two boys duck low to enter the triangular cavern formed by the slope of the embankment and the span of the bridge just above their heads. Here, the smell of brine is laced with the sour odor of unwashed fabric and dirty clothing. They move past what appears to be an encampment of sorts. For a moment, Stefan is confused. In communist East Germany, there are not supposed to be any homeless people. Everyone has a job. The state makes sure of it. The boots of the Tropos clank on the bridge's flat span, just above their heads. At the water's edge is an old stone wall, one of those urban relics from the end of the Second World War, when Berlin was a bombed-out husk of itself. Here and there, the wall is pocked with holes and missing bricks. Stefan leads Johann down by feel, silently willing the opposite side to be just as friendly to midnight climbers. Moving carefully, he slides his bare feet along the slick, slimy stones until he finds a toehold. Then he inches his way down. They could jump, of course, and easily survive. The height of the embankment isn't the problem. It's the noise of the splash he's worried about. His toe dips into the water. The cold zaps his entire body. What feels like an electric current buzzes through his teeth. He takes a breath and drops in. The wetsuit lessens the shock, but it's not a magic cloak. They have to get moving before their limbs go numb.
Not so bad,
Johann whispers, bobbing next to him in the black water. But Stefan can hear the strain in his friend's voice.
Tropical. Bathwater. Anyway, race you to the other side.
As Johann stretches out into a quick yet careful forward crawl, Stefan matches his strokes. Despite the incredible, breathtaking cold, Stefan feels a slight tug of satisfaction pulling him smoothly onward. He lets his mind flash to the upcoming 1964 Olympics in Tokyo. His nerves are distant, chattering at the edge of his mind, easily ignored. An open-hearted feeling washes over him. He always thought Johann would surely make the team, but why should he have to settle for a spectator's role? If he keeps training hard, there's no reason they can't keep the relay team together, all the way to the international stage. Swimming against the best in the world. As he knifes through the freezing harbor, sheltered by the train bridge, he imagines the rush of the water as the roar of a crowd. With the sensitivity of a sea creature, Stefan notes a sudden absence in the water at his side.
The Elritze has pulled ahead, outpacing him as they near the halfway point.
Stefan changes his strokes carefully. Unlike in a race, when he can focus all his energy toward that forward motion no matter how noisy it gets, he has to maintain a smooth, even stroke. His lightly cupped hands drag water like oars, propelling him onward. He feels the pleasant strain on the muscles of his upper back. The rhythmic quarter turns of his head provide quick glimpses of the strange aquatic cavern he finds himself in. So dark, so cold.
His Olympic daydream creeps around the edges of his mind, poking and prodding as he pursues his friend. The crowd roars. The cameras flash. Wait, the cameras flash. He comes to a dead stop in the water as his brain beats back the fantasy and reality pours in. A second searchlight pierces the night. Smaller than the first, dialed down to a precise beam that cuts through the darkness beneath the bridge. Stefan swivels his neck to the source. A small boat idling in the water, 10 meters away. A light is mounted on its bow, pinning Johan in the water. The Elwitz's face is twisted into a grimace as he stares into the brightness. Stefan's mind spins out. Johan can't see a thing, but Stefan can, and what he sees is a pair of Trappos flanking the mounted searchlight and raising their rifles. They yell for Johan to stop, which strikes him as absurd, because Johan is already frozen in place. Stefan realizes that they don't know he's here, and even if they do, they can't possibly see him if he stays well outside the scope of their searchlight. He could dive right now, swim through the depths until his lungs are set to burst, and come up for air far from the boat. He could climb out, retrieve his jacket and shoes, vanish into the night. His arms go up. His arms go down. He splashes. Hey! His voice rings out. Without a plan, without a thought, he flails and yells. Over here! The beam leaves Johan in the dark and zips across the water. A moment later, Stefan is blinded. Bright light is all around him. Johan! He screams. Go! Not without you! His friend calls back. There are orders being shouted from the boat by men he can't see. Be quiet, and swim toward us slowly. Stefan ignores them. I'll see you in Tokyo, he calls out to Johan. Then he plunges into the sightless depths. His body goes vertical, head down, feet up. He aims straight for the bottom. There's a sound like a distant hammer, a short, sharp strike of a nail into a wall. At the same time, the hammer strikes his leg just above his right knee. His body does a somersault. The darkness is so pure, up and down are jumbled. His leg goes numb and also heavy with a dull yet immense pain that seems to weigh him down. He has a wild flash of memory, a book about surviving an avalanche. The first thing you're supposed to do when you've come to a stop inside an enormous mound of snow is spit. You can always tell which way is up by the way your spit falls. But how is he supposed to do that in water? There is no gravity here. He commands his body to right itself. He commands his legs to kick, his arms to pull against a million billion tons of water flowing into the River Spree. There's another muffled, distant crack, and it's like someone slammed a huge piece of burning steel into his ribcage. It squirmed its way into his body, crowding out his lungs, weighing him down like an anchor. He must not have taken in enough air. Yes, that's it. He only has to swim to the surface, poke his head up, gulp some sweet oxygen. But he's spinning through the darkness, and it's so much colder down here now. How deep is Humboldt Harbor anyway? Then it hits him, and he nearly laughs despite this weird dizzy feeling that makes it hard to hold on to a thought for very long. The light. He only has to swim toward the searchlight. That's his version of spitting in the snow. Sure, the men with their guns will be waiting for him, but he needs air. At least on the surface he'll have a chance. He aims his body toward the distant pool of light. For a moment, nothing happens. Then, as he tries to put together a kick, which doesn't work because his body's like a stopped clock, the searchlight widens and grows and comes down toward him, seeking him, angling itself through the depths as it fills the harbor with light. When that vast beam reaches him, he finds that he's no longer cold. There's another crack, this one impossibly distant, like it's coming from the world outside his window as he sleeps, echoing through a winter dream. Something tugs at the back of his neck, near the base of his spine, but it doesn't pull him down. It lifts him up, up, up through the radiant light. He doesn't even need to kick his legs or move his arms. It's like when the swim team does backstroke drills in practice and he propels himself with the lane divider for a little added momentum when coach isn't looking. Everybody does it, even Diaritza. It's just a little private joke among the team. And then the strangest thing. He is swimming again, outside the water, rising through the night air. There are the Trapos on the bridge, excited and chattering and milling about like ants in a colony, pointing down into the water, peering over the rail's edge. But it's hard to spare them a moment's thought, because all his senses have come screaming back now that he's out of the murky depths. All around him, Berlin sparkles. The stately columns of the Brandenburg Gate, the Palace of Charlottenburg, the blinking lights of the tower at Tempelhof Airport, and due east, his apartment block in Prenzlauerberg, where his parents and his sister Marta and Penelope, the Rottweiler, sleep without the faintest idea that he has snuck out to swim across the border. He finds that it's hard to spare even them a moment's thought, because as he rides the jet stream up through the clouds, he's a radio antenna for the divided city as it sleeps. Or tries to. Thousands of citizens toss and turn, kept awake by thoughts of this new wall that split their beloved Berlin in two. The city, pregnant with decades of conflict, has birthed an abomination.
"It began with the war,"
thinks an old woman in Spandau, pulling her woolen blankets up to her chin. "No," thinks a man in Kreuzberg, where the barbed wire has split the street in two. "It began with the other war, the earlier one, which in its horrors paved the way for the second." Another insomniac voice joins the chorus that floats above the city. "You're both wrong. It's the fault of the decadent Westerners, the Americans and the British and the French. If it weren't for their violent imperialist ways, we wouldn't need the anti-fascist protection barrier in the first place."
"You fool," adds a voice from Neukolln. "What kind of sick government needs a wall to keep its citizens in? That's communism for you. No wonder everyone in the East wants to escape to the West."
Stefan's last thought before it all becomes mist is this. It's strange how everyone is fixated on the stupid wall, when from up here there's only one Berlin. No East, no West, no anti-fascist protection barrier. Just one country, one city, one people. Neues Deutschland newspaper, front page story, November 14, 1961. It is the right of every nation to protect its borders. What do the Western nations use to protect theirs? Friendly maidens who confront illegal border crossers with empty hands and apologetic smiles? Perhaps a single line painted on the ground and a sign urging politely, "Please do not cross here"? Is Great Britain in the business of allowing all manner of foreign agents to cross back and forth with nothing but a stern warning not to misbehave? Do the French and the Americans allow anyone to sail to their shores or land in their airports without passing through a checkpoint? Let us not mince words. There will be the usual moral scolding and hand-wringing judgment passed down from the anti-socialist elements. We all must disregard the empty words of hypocrites and forge ahead. Before the smears and lies come shrieking in from the West, we present you, the people of our glorious Workers' and Peasants' Republic, with the simple facts. Last night, two young men we have long suspected of spying for the West attempted to cross our border. Their purpose was to hand over information to be used in violent acts of sabotage against the people of the German Democratic Republic. Our brave border guards were forced to use their weapons to prevent this illegal crossing and the mayhem that would surely follow. In the process, one of the spies, Johann Hoffmann, was taken into custody. His partner in crimes against the state, Stefan Dietrich, attempted to break free, endangering the lives of our border guards and nearby citizens. Left with no recourse and concerned above all with public safety, these men were forced to do their duty. Stefan Dietrich thereby died. In the coming days, the West will try to paint this criminal as a hero. Make no mistake, he died as he lived, an enemy of the German people. Chapter 1. December 9, 1961.
There's been another one.
Marta Dietrich's father sets his Saturday edition of Neues Deutschland down on the kitchen table. The apartment goes silent. Marta pauses with a forkful of sliced banana, a rare breakfast treat, halfway to her mouth. Her mother rests a hand on her mug full of Rostwein, the coffee that hovers at around 50% genuine beans. Nobody moves. Then, slowly, her mother lowers her magazine. Marta's eyes flick to the cover, where a blonde model is smiling like the world has just opened up its arms to greet her, over the words, "New Styles for Winter." Marta glances at her father's hands as he folds them atop the newspaper and bows his head. Scattered words jump out from the page, peeking out from around his wrists. Criminal, spy, guards, duty, east, west, Americans. It might as well be that same dreadful article about her brother, Stefan, with the words rearranged. All these Neues Deutschland articles about border crossers tell the same story. An evil spy getting the justice he deserves. The SED, the East German Communist Party, arranges reality the way they see fit. Marta saw the newspaper, Der Spiegel, published in the West before the wall went up. That paper sounds like someone laying out basic facts. Neues Deutschland sounds like someone desperate to prove a point. Marta eats banana slices. Her mother sips coffee. Her father gets up from the table. He goes to a small chalkboard on the wall and adds a line to the 10 tally marks he's already made. He presses the chalk so hard, Marta's afraid it will break. Her father stands there, silently contemplating the tally.
11, he says.
11 East Germans killed trying to cross the border since the wall went up on August 13. Her brother, Stefan, was number 8. Marta's eyes go to the 8th tally mark. It looks the same as the rest, a white line on a chalkboard, all that's left of her older brother. Above the tally is a basic grocery list, milk, butter, eggs, potatoes. The list never changes. It's only there to provide cover for the tally should their apartment be visited by an agent of the Ministry for State Security, the secret police. The Stasi. They have paid Marta's family a visit on 4 separate occasions since Stefan's death. To the Stasi, the Dietriches have 2 massive red flags in their file. Stefan's border crossing attempt and Marta's mother's former job in West Germany. Anyone who worked in the West before the wall went up is now viewed with suspicion. Her father puts down the piece of chalk and wanders over to the toaster. He lays a finger on the spring-loaded switch and presses it down. It pops back up. There's no bread in the toaster. It's not even plugged in. He peers into the empty slots, mutters to himself, then turns to the frost-rimmed window. He rolls up his left sleeve, then unrolls it and lets it dangle from his forearm, loose and unbuttoned. Marta slides the newspaper over to her side of the table and spins it so she can read the article.
Marta, her mother says, but the warning is half-hearted.
The argument could be scripted at this point. They've had it so many times.
I'm 12, Mutti, not 7. You're 12, Marta, not 17.
17, Stefan's age. As old as he'll ever be. Marta stabs another stack of banana slices and runs her eyes down the article. She's not really sure what her mother is trying to protect her from. The worst possible thing has already happened. The scene described in the article paints itself into her mind. A railway goods station, the small hours of the morning, wisps of fog, flickering streetlights. A wild-eyed man in his 20s, kneeling in a frigid puddle, trying to pry open a hastily made barrier that divides the train tracks. When spotted by the heroic border guards, he attempted to flee back into the east, from where he'd come. The guards pursued him through the streets and shot him anyway, a few blocks from his home. The point is clear. Even if you turn back, even if you have second thoughts, we will use lethal force to punish you. What had they called Stefan? An enemy of the German people. Marta taps a finger against the poorly printed text. Some letters are gray, some smudged nearly to black.
They call this guy a leech, sucking the blood of our healthy body.
She imagines a slimy, man-sized grub writhing and slurping at the heart of East Germany itself, sinking his teeth into the pavement of Unter den Linden.
It's a metaphor, her mother explains.
Until August, Alma Dietrich had been a literature teacher in a secondary school in the Moabit neighborhood of West Berlin. She had been one of the thousands of East Berliners whose work took them on a daily commute over the border in the morning and back home to the East in the evenings. Now, there is no more work in the West for residents of the East. The education system here has no place for someone accustomed to teaching students Western values. Alma Dietrich
has been reassigned by the labor.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?